This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of Rivian's new investors hopes to help the company with more than just money.
We do a lot of infleeting and defleeting of fleets today, so that'll just be one more offering that we can help Rivian with.
Cox Automotive Mobility Group President Joe George talks about the give and take of the company's $350 million stake in Rivian. Plus, Eric Stock reports Bloomington police are seeing the same increases reported nationally in online child sexual violence crimes. Many minor league baseball teams are taking a hit as major league teams drop affiliations. Hear about some of them in Illinois. A remembrance for a longtime Central Illinois broadcaster who has passed on, and the mayor of Normal stops by.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Normal Town Council has narrowly approved a property tax levy for next year of just under $13 million. The mayors of Normal and Bloomington join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Koos is in studio with us to recap last night's meeting and talk about other issues. Mayor Koos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Always fun to be here.
The vote on the levy was 4-3. Is the council dynamic solidifying now? Can we expect a lot of 4-3 votes in the future?
Oh, I don't think so. I think, you know, in certain issues like property taxes, taxation in general, I think you are going to see some splits on that. But generally, other issues, there's often not unanimous votes, which is fine. There's disagreement, but I don't see this going forward as a 4-3 council.
There was a slight addition to the levy from the original draft the council used to direct staff to prepare the levy at last month's meeting, and that is enough money to hire a communications director. What will that person do?
You know, I think there's been too much emphasis put on that issue. the sense of the fact that the $96,000 was pulled out 2 weeks ago was a budget impact that was not discussed. And it was, I wouldn't call it a huge budget impact, but it was a budget impact nonetheless. And the town budgets very, very tightly. And so because that happened so quickly without discussion at that meeting, city manager had to react and say, well, where do we plug the hole in that budget now that we don't have that money? And her choice was to hold off on making that hire. So that's kind of the background on that. A communications person, to answer your question, is more about putting out information about what the town's doing, almost on a day-to-day basis, and we frankly don't have anybody on staff that can do that.
Why is that person important now rather than 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years from now?
I think in the world of the internet and social media, it's more important to be able to tell from a factual standpoint what's happening within a unit of government. Because there's so much chatter out there, I think we need to be equally represented.
The council decided to halt accelerated payments to fire and police pensions to keep the size of the levy closer to last year's levy, and they decided that last month, and they kept to that, even with the addition for the communications director. Feel free to quibble with this framing, but why is a communications director more important to the council than accelerating the payments toward 100% funding by 2040?
You know, again, I'm the wrong person to ask that question because I don't see this about a communications person. The communications person is somebody that's been in our strategic plan for the last 3 or 4 years as an important entity within the town. It was budgeted for. So I think the fact that there was a surprise in the property tax levy kind of put city manager in a tough position to have to make a choice. I see these as two separate issues. Now, I'm not speaking for the full council, but I see them as two separate issues.
The addition drew a couple objections. Scott Preston and Stan Nord said making changes to the draft ordinance already presented to the public is bad practice. Now, you've already partially addressed that by saying that there hadn't been time to for staff to react to the change last month and that it's okay. But is it bad practice to shift again, and will it create distrust of local governments as members Nord mm-hmm. and Preston alleged?
I think it's a fair question, and the reason I thought it was important is because what I consider a significant budget issue was done on the fly without conversation, without being part of the budgeting process. And to me, that was a correction of that. And, you know, I certainly could go with the argument two wrongs don't make a right. But, you know, my vote was to take things back to status quo, that if we're going to adjust a budget, there needs to be discussion about it and not just throw out an amendment and 3 minutes later we voted a budget change.
So if you can, as Councilmember McCarthy said, if you can change it on the fly one time, you can change it on the fly again mm-hmm. after due deliberation.
You know, if it happens at the table, I will certainly take a position that this is not the time or place to have that discussion.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Mayor Chris Koos of the Town of Normal. The General Assembly voted in the fall veto session to combine fire and police pensions across the state into one bundle. That's supposed to improve rates of return on investments. State Senator Jason Berrickman and other area lawmakers voted against it, saying it leaves a whole lot of unresolved questions. They didn't like those blank spots. What's your take on that?
Well,
that
if there are blank spots, then they need to be worked out. I agree with that. But the overarching idea that you'll have significant dollars being handled under one pension fund goes to improved efficiencies and allows you to be a bigger player in the world of pension investing. I mean, IMRF is an example that proves that does work very well. The IMRF returns have been pretty good. And it's a well-run organization. Now, the idea that you have 250 or 300 different small pension funds, you're not as important in the world of investment as a large investor.
So taking IMRF as another kind of example, there is a requirement for municipal employees of the municipalities to pay every year what they think is an adequate amount of money.
Right.
And there's no ability, if you're part of IMRF, to shirk. Should that be the same with this new combined pension system?
In my opinion, yes. It should be.
That was not part of the legislation.
No. Then maybe we should change that legislation.
Okay.
Everyone
agrees that even if rates of return improve from the bundling, it won't solve the pension funding adequacy problem. Are there other moves legislatively or within the town or as best practices among municipalities to address it other than cities and towns cutting services to fund pensions?
You know, that's dancing on the edge of a razor for municipalities. You know, I've been in local government for 18 years now, and during that entire time, pension enhancements and that have been decided by the state legislature and handed to the municipalities to figure out how to pay for them. And, you know, we're at the end of a lot of that. Right now with police and fire pensions. It's caught up to us, and we're going to have to figure out creative ways to deal with it. And, you know, 2 years ago we did a 7% across-the-board budget cut to try and stem some of that activity. We have to balance being able to provide high-quality services, maintain a quality of life in our community, while meeting our financial obligations, and it's tough right now, and it's probably going to get tougher.
We're now hearing on a completely different topic of the demolition of three buildings and the start of construction on the Trail East project in Uptown won't happen until the spring.
Right.
Your reaction to that development on the proposed mixed-use project on the Circle?
I was a little frustrated by it, but I've talked to the major tenants, and they're okay with the delay till spring. So in that sense, I'm fine with it.
Is it still going to happen? You're sure?
It will happen.
All right.
It will happen.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Mayor Chris Goose of Normal. The town and the city of Bloomington recently canceled a joint meeting to discuss a potential multi-sport complex. Okay. What's that mean?
We just felt we weren't ready to have that meeting. We didn't know going into it what we'd be talking about because we really didn't have any new information other than what came out of the SFA report 16 months ago. My two representatives on CBB board were very adamant about the fact we had no new information. Why are we having this meeting? What are we going to talk about? So I kind of took their lead on that.
So the study, as you mentioned, is 16 months old. It had an 18-month window of usefulness, viability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all but aged out of relevance now. Is the concept dead for Bloomington Normal, absent some private portion of this proposed public-private partnership coming forward?
I wouldn't say so. I think talking about updating the study and going further is to get deeper information to look at some site selection for that group to say, here are here's what is happening in the public-private world that makes these things work. So giving us that information for our decision-making, I think, is going to be a lot more helpful, and then would be a good time for a joint meeting.
That group? Which group would that be?
SFA.
Oh, no, I thought you were talking about a potential private partner.
Well, there are multiple groups out there. Oh. There are companies all over the United States that are doing this kind of work. Locally, Core Construction does this kind of work on a national level, where they will partner with a municipality, and whether it's they own it and lease it back, they build it and get development rights to all the property around. There are so many around it. There are so many scenarios in a public-private partnership.
So is the town willing to plunk down another $40,000 to $60,000 on an updated study that will again age out if nothing happens?
Well, theoretically, aging out, I think what it does is it takes us to a decision point. So, yes, I think it's that way. You know, it could be 20,000, it could be 40,000, it could be 60,000. It's a 3-month study done month to month. And if it, halfway through that point we decide, well, this is not going anywhere where we think, let's pull the plug and call it a day. But it's important that it's not the town. It's the town and the city that are making these decisions.
Is the city willing to share the town's expense on that? They didn't the last time.
CBB is actually
okay
paying for it.
Well, let's switch to another topic here on 89.1 and WGLT.org.
You've got like a spinning wheel for
topics
today.
That's right. Yeah. It's a long one. Property tax appeals. There were 879 complaints filed by taxpayers in 2019, down about 2% in the number from last year, slightly above the 5-year average, according to the supervisor of assessments, Bob Common. Each is challenging what their township assessor has determined to be their assessed value. A lot of these are business challenges. The big owners are often successful at negotiating the assessment down a little bit. Is the system unfair to the regular homeowner whose values have also taken a hit from the State Farm restructuring a couple years ago, but who haven't seen lower assessments?
You know, you're asking me questions I can't objectively answer because I haven't studied that hard. The fact that if people go in and say, here's the market value of my home, here's what the homes around me have sold for, I think this is the value, I think they've got a very legitimate issue to deal with in an appeal process. Now, how that goes through, I couldn't tell you.
Technically, they have access to the appeal process, but they don't have as much expertise or resources and time. They got to go out and make a living, as opposed to someone who works for one of these larger businesses who gets paid to consider these kinds of questions.
They hire people that are professionals.
So should the system change to make it easier for the little guys to gain access?
Okay, I'll give you that, yes. But how do you change it?
Well, you're in government. You could probably figure that out.
Not according to some people.
All right. One of the appeals was from Nord Enterprises, the owner of some industrial space. Nord says the arrival of Rivian and Brand in McLean County has clouded the market for industrial properties. Overall, the market is, quote, saturated with available industrial space. Much of the industrial market will remain vacant in hopes that both Rivian and Brand continue to draw in additional jobs and support industries that will potentially occupy some of the industrial space left vacant by Mitsubishi's exit. So that's according to Nord, that we're in sort of a waiting period, and so property values for industrial space should go down. What's your take on the pulse of industrial property and commercial property in the town?
Well, you know, I'm not an appraiser of properties in that, and so we're talking about philosophy here more than we are about the value of properties. I will say that I don't agree with that statement, given the activity at EDC for people that are coming in looking for industrial applications within the community. I don't see, and I'm talking for myself, I don't see the basis for the argument that industrial property is going down in value when industrial activity is increasing.
So you're seeing actually more interest now. We're in a good economy, right?
Yeah, we are.
So how much more? I mean, without obviously naming names.
Yeah, that's up to the private sector to make that determination. And the EDC can't give out information on, you know, they have code names like Project Laser and that because...
They can give you numbers of touches, though, and they do that.
Well, they do that.
So what's the activity?
I would say at an EDC last evening, we talked briefly about five projects going on in the Bloomington Normal area. Potential projects.
Mid-size? Biggies?
Well, one group.
Small singles group, hits? You know?
One group came in for a full day and asked questions and wouldn't even give the people at EDC or the state their last names because they want to keep a lid on what they're doing. And you got to respect the privacy from a competitive advantage that they not show their full hand when they're going out site selecting.
So some other property tax appeals involve the owners of Eastland Mall and Colonial Plaza area in Bloomington, which continue to hurt from the Amazon effect, the continued shift to retail. Is there a sign in your looking at this issue when we might hit the bottom level for retail space?
I was at a conference last week in Oklahoma City, and we had a retail specialist talking about that issue. And there's some interesting trends, and she talked a lot about millennial shopping habits. And one of the things she talked about was that millennials are moving to what they call experiential brick-and-mortar environments. They like that. So, yes, the face of retail is changing dramatically. The other thing that she brought up, and I've seen this in other instances or other references, there's about 41 square feet per capita of retail space in the United States. In most of the industrialized Europe, it's 4 square feet per capita. 15, 20 years ago in the United States, it was 4 square feet per capita. And so we have overbuilt retail in this country, and it focuses mainly on the big box stores and that. They're all regrouping like crazy to get into smaller footprints. They're going back to their leaseholders and negotiating lower rates because the face of retail has changed dramatically.
So a couple lines of thought here. First, going back to what your analyst was telling you in this session, what is an experiential shopping? What do millennials look for?
You know, I think it's going into an environment where there's an activity related to what they're shopping for. There's expertise for what they're shopping for. It's not just discount. I'm going into a discount retailer. I need this sweater. I'm going to find the $5 sweater as opposed to the $6 sweater.
So a return to expertise and service in the retail arena.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes against, potentially against, the smaller footprint of shops.
I don't see how it does.
So there are going to be more specialty shops.
I think more specialty, and I think, you take stores like Best Buy and Kohl's and that, they're shrinking their footprint, and they have different philosophies on why they're doing that. And then let's throw this into the mix. Take a look at the Amazon 400 store that has the 400 best-selling items in Amazon in a bricks-and-mortar store.
So given these trends, how is Normal positioned for this future?
Well, again, I think that's a question for the private sector. We tend to respond to the needs of the private sector, the retail sector, and what they want and what they want to do. Does it have impact if we have a lot of commercial real estate go vacant? Yeah, absolutely it does. But we work with developers for redoing projects like, I can't think of the name of the project, but we're Bed Bath and Beyond and that array of businesses. There are businesses there that are planning on shrinking in size and bringing in new retailers into that. It's a dynamic process. Things don't hold still.
So what does it portend for the town in the kinds of projects it considers for potential incentives?
Well, you know,
would a trail east fit this new news landscape, for instance, or would what will Trail West have to look like to fit this new landscape?
Well, so now are we talking office? Are we talking retail? Are we talking residential?
Well,
I thought we were talking retail there to start off.
But mixed use includes retail components.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So
people, just based on the numbers we get in sales tax returns in Uptown Normal, does that smaller experiential retailer prosper? Yes.
This is Sound Ideas. Mayor Coos, thanks for your time today on 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Always good to be here.
The mayors of Normal and Bloomington join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, presenting Amazing Alleluias at 7:30 Saturday, December 7th at Bloomington Second Presbyterian Church, featuring soprano Awet Adebakale, works by Vivaldi, Mozart, and more. Details at ilsymphony.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, trends in online sexual violence against children are increasing exponentially, and even in central Illinois. Eric Stock reports. Rivian's multi-million dollar investments from Amazon and Ford have received a lot of attention. That left Cox Automotive's $350 million investment in September a bit overshadowed. Cox is less of a household name and perhaps known for its brands like Auto Trader, Kelley Blue Book, and Manheim. For the first time, Cox Mobility Group President Joe George tells WGLT's Ryan Denham about why Rivian was their first equity investment in an automaker and what they hope to learn.
First and foremost, how electric vehicles are going to impact the auto industry. We have a pretty extensive presence in the wholesale and retail automobile business. And so from things like how to value a battery pack in the used market, because there's such a part of the value of a new electric vehicle. And in order to do that, you have to have a pretty good understanding of the charge discharge histories of the batteries. And so, part of working with the Rivian team is just to learn about how these battery packs wear over time, and so that we can do a good job informing the aftermarket and ultimately consumers about the health of the battery and then the corresponding value.
You mentioned your interest in Rivian was in part on trying to get a better handle on things like how to value a battery pack, once it hits the used market. Can you, even go bigger picture and talk about what attracted you to Rivian as a company? There are any number of places where you could study batteries, but why Rivian? What was attractive about them?
Yeah, I think we like the fact that they're an all-electric manufacturer. You know, the Cox family has been very active in sustainability over the past decade. We have a program called Cox Conserves, where we're making investments across different clean technologies and sustainable food production and helping businesses do a better job managing their carbon footprint. And so when the Rivian announcement came along and we met RJ and we, you know, his philosophy around, making the planet a better place through electrification and transportation, we're very intrigued. Then when you go into his philosophy around the skateboard, which has, you can have multiple implementations or form factors that you can put on top of the skateboard, we just thought that was very compelling because we think a lot of the future of how we get from point A to point B for goods and package delivery is along the lines of, what Amazon's contemplating doing. So, we knew Amazon was going to be part of it, and we just felt like, as well as Ford, we just felt like it was the right alchemy of partners. And also the vehicle is, when you start fresh, you can develop the operating system from the ground up. So there's a lot of really interesting things around connectivity.
What can you say at this point about what you guys will be doing for Rivian? I mean, other than you learning from kind of the battery side of it, what are the other things that kind of make up this partnership?
Well, I think the main is just knowledge transfer in and around the battery systems and how can we help the whole industry together do a better job of assessing a battery EV vehicle so that, people bid in the secondary market the appropriate price, because that helps with residual values, which then helps consumers with more affordable payments. So that's where a lot of our energy is going to be. And I think as you pan back and you look at the second life, secondary use, and recycling of these battery systems, we're very interested as part of our Cox Conserves effort into where the battery cells go once they've gone past their effective life in an automotive application. We don't want them going into landfills, so we're really aggressively looking at different ways to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think our listeners may not realize just all the things that could be potential second lives for these batteries once they've done what they do with the vehicles. What are some of those potential second uses that you think could be more commonplace in the years to come?
Rivian is looking to help in Puerto Rico, a village where there's inconsistent power grid, level out with power storage based on their battery packs. Great test of that hypothesis. As far as other second use, the challenge today is the cost of the new battery cells is coming down as more and more demand and more capacity is developed. So it's a little bit of a challenge because a lot of storage applications, you're able to buy the batteries new cheaper than you can get them into the secondary use market. But we think it's just a matter of time before there'll be enough supply where, we'll be able to develop things like home storage of energy and, fleet depot type grid, microgrids to help with regenerating and balancing out how power is pulled off of the grid so that you can pull power off at times where it's optimal and then push the power out of the battery storage systems and into the vehicles themselves. So it's just really early, but there's a lot of really great opportunities there. And then the recycling, just making sure that these batteries don't go into the landfills, and how we can responsibly reuse them and recycle them is another whole area of opportunity.
Are you guys going to be doing any kind of anything on the service end for Rivian?
We're going to help with their commercial fleet work with the Amazon vehicles and help with through our Manheim business, we do a lot of in-fleeting and defleeting of of fleets today. So we'll just that'll just be one more offering that we can help Rivian with in fleeting those vehicles.
Well, let's take a step back and talk kind of big picture electrification and dealerships across the country. I know Cox has longstanding relationships with dealers. Are they ready for this electric vehicle revolution that has long been coming? Where are the kind of blind spots there?
For those like General Motors dealers and now Ford dealers and Mercedes and BMW dealers, Fiat dealers, they've had an initial shipments of new electric vehicles, and so they're getting themselves prepared. I think that the broader industry is really moving more quickly towards preparing themselves just because of the commercial fleets that we see going electric very rapidly. And then there's a lot of new models announced over the next, 4 to 5 years that are all electric. And the dealers are starting to install the charging infrastructure and educating their salespeople on, the benefits of an electric vehicle. And then having to transition at least part of their service department over to high voltage service. So, like anything, I think there's a group of early movers, but I think we've moved towards the back end of that, and now the height of the bell curve is starting to get engaged.
How much of a bell curve is it? How big of a shift is that going to be when you get into service lanes and trade-in desks and all that?
Yeah, I think what's 2% today turns into 5%, turns into 10%, turns into 25% of the fleet and sales. At least a quarter of what you're doing is going to have to be educated or prepared for dealing with electric vehicle appraisals. And then ultimately the ownership experience for the consumer around educating on how to charge and what service elements are needed to keep the vehicle going. I think it's, fortunately, we have some time to go through an education process from the OEMs and then companies like Cox Automotive and Rivian to the dealer network to get them ready.
And there are all sorts of projections out there about how quickly this electrification movement will actually come. In which projection do you put the most stock in? I mean, how quickly are we going to see this happen now that there are so many new models coming out and we've been stuck at 1-2% for so long?
If you look at the dialogue right now, it's all going to be about how consumers react to all the new models and supply. There's still range anxiety is still, a core issue. And then the initial cost of purchase. But all that being said, there's so many new models from, at different price points that, we're really going to get a good gauge of, is the American consumer ready? So beside that is the commercial fleets where, the total cost of ownership around operating an electric fleet is, more attractive than an internal combustion engine. Plus, a lot of these companies have aggressive sustainability effort objectives. And so long way of saying, I think we're going to see rapid adoption in the commercial fleet sector, which will drive a lot of volume as we gauge and the market gauges where consumers are from a demand standpoint.
So if you're looking at rapid adoption of the commercial fleet, are there still any barriers in that space? Are there things that are problems yet to be solved that once you get over those humps, it should go pretty quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic, how are you going to charge them all? And, where will you charge them? Do you charge them at fleet depots? Do you charge them at delivery centers? And I think the industry is starting to energize around where and how to make sure that there's the appropriate chargers. And then you have grid implications around do you have the appropriate transformer or capacity around these charging depots to make sure that you have the actual electrons that can safely flow through the chargers and the battery. That all needs to just play out. But I have confidence in the industry and the state governments to make sure that we've got the capital and the resources to make that happen. We're in a little bit of a chicken and the egg, right? You got to have the demand in order to generate the need to develop the supply.
That's Joe George, Mobility Group President at Cox Automotive, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham. Cox announced this fall it has invested $350 million in Rivian. You can catch up to all our Rivian coverage at WGLT.org/Rivian.
On Giving Tuesday, many nonprofits ask for donations. So who do you give to? It's Rachel Martin from NPR. And when you give, you want to know your donation is put to good use. With public radio, you know your money is making a difference. Thanks to listeners who donate, the journalism you trust is available to everyone. Your gift supports the news you need here at home and around the world. This Giving Tuesday, you have a lot of choices. Supporting this station is a smart one.
Giving Tuesday is $10 Tuesday. Make your first-time $10 a month contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Central Illinois Regional Airport in Bloomington, offering Frontier Airlines flights nonstop to Orlando International three times per week this winter. CIRA says don't travel before you travel. Fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up on the program, Major League Baseball gives a waiver to many of its minor league affiliates. We'll look at what's happening in Illinois. Police consider the web to be a vital resource in helping fight and prevent crime, but often perpetrators are able to stay a step ahead. A recent New York Times investigation indicates tech companies saw the number of online photos and videos of children being sexually abused more than double over just the last year to 45 million. And this form of cybercrime has grown exponentially in the last decade. WGLT's Eric Stock talks with law enforcement in Bloomington Normal to see what increase they see and whether they have adequate staffing to handle it.
Let's consider the term child pornography. Billy Lynn has investigated these cases for Bloomington Police for 14 years. He doesn't call it that. Lynn says he considers the term too tame to explain what is likely the worst day in a child's life.
It would be more accurately described as the visual depiction of the violent sexual assault of children, more often than not. And I think that seems to ring a little bit different when you describe it that way.
Lynn says this underground industry has evolved dramatically. When he started work on such cases, most of the contraband went through the mail.
The U.S. Postal Inspectors years ago used to be the primary investigators of this stuff because a lot of it had to go through the mail. Of course, then the internet popped up and the ease in which people can trade these images became so much more. It started normalizing a lot of that behavior and more people started becoming involved in it.
The advent of smartphones, social media, and cloud storage led to the online explosion of illegal materials. Lynn says perpetrators peddle them on the dark web through encryption that prevents the general public and law enforcement from finding the content through conventional search engines.
To be honest, there are so many of them, we don't have time to work them all. We don't have the bodies to work them all.
Lynn says the truly heinous get the most attention.
There's that whole difference. I mean, you have a toddler being raped compared to a 16 or 17 year old maybe allowing her pictures to be taken. So you have to decide, and they're both wrong, but you have to look at which is more serious and which ones to go after.
Lynn says he's not just looking at the severity of the images and videos, but also who is likely consuming it.
We look for those that are obviously prepubescent, that are not just posing, but they're actually being sexually assaulted, and we go after those. It's been my experience that when you get the people that have a sexual interest in those types of images, they're highly likely to have committed a hands-on offense, and that's what we're really going after.
In Normal, online sex crimes aren't as much of a burden, according to Police Chief Rick Bleichner.
We have sufficient resources to investigate the complaints that we've received. It does take some time to work through those because it's a resource allocation issue.
Bleichner says his department has seen some increase in recent years. Normal gets about one online sex crime case per month on average, and sometimes they fall into another jurisdiction. He says finding a physical location for these crimes can get tricky. Many originate overseas. Bleichner says the biggest investigative challenge is sifting through the overwhelming number of online records.
Prior to, you know, the explosion of the internet, you could send a subpoena to a bank and get bank records, or send a subpoena to somewhere and get emails. But now, you know, you've got these large volumes of storage and data and media that now you have to, once you get, then you have access to, then you have to sort through that.
Technology companies are supposed to look proactively for illicit activity. Police say they rarely do. BPD's Billy Lynn says at the very least, the companies need to help police track down a case when they get a tip.
A lot of these companies don't have the ability or choose not to police their own systems. Some of these decentralized applications, these things aren't really going through the servers. They're just connecting from point to point.
Police at Normal encounter similar challenges. Chief Rick Bleichner says it requires patience.
It does. Sometimes takes a little while. Sometimes we have to word it a certain way to get exactly what we want. But our investigators are pretty good at having contacts at those particular tech companies to help to call them to say, here's what I'm looking for. What do you need?
The Illinois Attorney General's Office can help municipal police agencies. The Attorney General launched the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force more than 20 years ago. It provides free training and equipment and helps local departments pool resources to investigate online sex crimes. BPD's Billy Lynn says that's helpful, but it's still not enough. He says he's not sure there ever can be enough help to pursue every sexual predator online.
You could probably throw three or four more bodies per department at combating online child pornography and still hardly put a dent in it.
Bloomington Police Chief Dan Doneth says child pornography is a big problem, but it's only one of many kinds of crime.
But we all have to operate within the constraints of budgets and, you know, and the reality of running the city. And we know what our constraints are in regards to our manpower. And so we try to allocate that, you know, proportionately as best we can.
Officer Billy Lynn says one tool that's helped law enforcement in recent years is tougher sentencing guidelines in the state.
They've since made great changes and great sentencing enhancements on these charges. When we first started, we took most of our cases federal because we had the bigger hammer in the federal system.
Child pornography possession carries a sentence of 4 to 15 years in prison. Anyone convicted of producing or distributing child pornography faces a mandatory minimum of 10 years behind bars. Lynn says he wants tougher sentencing for these criminals just to get them off the street. He says it's not about creating a deterrent. He doesn't think that works for these type of criminals.
These people are driven by something they honestly have a hard time controlling. It's almost an addiction that they can't they know it's wrong. They hide it. It's their secret side. They don't want anyone to know about it, but that feeling seems to overwhelm most of them, and they just continue to do it no matter what the cost.
And spending a working life investigating crimes that rob children of their innocence could easily make someone angry. Lynn says he's not. He says he feels mostly pity for the offenders.
I've come to the opinion that people do not have the conscious choice of what they find sexually attractive, and a lot of these people that seem to find children sexually attractive sometimes can't control their behavior.
Many of these crimes will never be prosecuted. There are too many for police to track, and Lynn says the technology is moving so fast that police are always playing catch-up. I'm Eric Stock.
A spokesperson for State Attorney General Kwame Raoul says the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force has been involved in more than 1,700 arrests of predators, sexual predators, since 2006, and has provided Internet training and education to thousands of law enforcement professionals and hundreds of thousands of parents, teachers, and students. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org. Major League Baseball is considering a plan that would eliminate 42 teams from the minor leagues, and some local teams are among them. Zach Wilson reports.
The Clinton Lumber Kings and Burlington Bees are on the list, and the Quad Cities River Bandits could be added to it. The MLB wants to totally realign its minor league system, but has not yet provided its reasoning to the public. The current contract with Minor League Baseball ends following the 2020 season, providing an opportunity to restructure at that time. Jeff Lance, Senior Director of Communications for Minor League Baseball, says he hopes the two sides can work something out.
It's just hard to fathom, you know, what the problem is in some of those markets for sure. So we have yet to hear exactly why those 42 teams were selected or be given, you know, real good reasons. But hopefully that'll take place here in the next few weeks and in the negotiation process, and eventually we can get a deal worked out that's beneficial for both sides.
Quad Cities River Bandits owner Dave Heller says there is no chance his team will be eliminated.
It's 100% certain that Quad Cities will not get contracted. I will do whatever I have to do, spend whatever I have to spend to make sure that the Quad Cities ballpark exceeds all minor league standards and provides a great opportunity for major league teams to develop its players.
He says that the MLB sent out surveys to each team in the league asking them which of their minor league teams they would eliminate. These were sent out in June while flooding was an issue up and down the Mississippi River, as well as in some of the stadiums. So, naturally, teams in this area caught a bad break and were selected. Lumber Kings general manager Ted Torno says he thinks the league is doing it largely to save money on payroll, but they only pay each player $1,500 per month for teams at the Lumber Kings level, which pales in comparison to massive contracts in higher leagues.
Player-wise, you're looking at about a payroll of about $200,000. Each club just got from the Fox $5.1 billion deal, $170 million split equally between 30 teams. And they're crying about $200,000.
Torno says these are teams that are deeply important, not just to the brand of baseball, but to their communities.
We're community owned. So that in and of itself is probably the number one thing. I have 1,000 shareholders who purchase stock. Okay. So since 1937, there's been shares of stock sold and baseball's been played here in the facility.
The River Bandits, on the other hand, are well known for their charitable work throughout the area. Dave Heller says he wishes the MLB would recognize the value that these teams bring outside of just putting a product on the field.
We pay out $85,000 worth of college scholarships every single year to students in the Quad Cities, to go to schools in the Quad Cities. We pay for free flu shots for every child in the Quad Cities. We raise $101,000 in partnership with Genesis to help victims of this past year's horrific flood. The impact of getting rid of the Quad Cities River Bandits in the Quad Cities would be enormous.
In addition, Heller says the team employs around 200 people at Modern Woodman Park throughout the entire season, and per game, the Lumber Kings employ 35-plus people to run the park.
That's IPR reporter Zach Wilson talking about Major League contracting of affiliate clubs. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Longtime radio broadcaster Ken Behrens of Bloomington Normal is being remembered for his sense of humor and upbeat outlook, even as he stared down the disease that took his life. WGLT's Eric Stock looks back at the life of Ken Behrens. He lost a lengthy battle with cancer at age 71.
Behrens is best known for the 3 decades he spent behind the mic at WJBC in Bloomington. Former colleague Dan Sweeney calls Behrens the most prepared broadcaster he ever knew. He says that's what made him so good at his craft.
He had the lost art of storytelling without making him the biggest part of the story. I could just listen to all of his stories about the era that I think he loved and appreciated the most of the early part of the last century.
Sweeney says he thinks of Behrens as an old soul, noting his love of antique cars.
If there's ever a person that I wanted to use the word reincarnated, Ken would be the guy. Because I just have this feeling that there's a person inside Ken that was there 100 years ago.
Mary Simon worked with Behrens for decades as he promoted the Conklin Barn Dinner Theater she owns in Goodfield while he was a radio host. Behrens also performed at the barn several times himself as a stand-up comic and as an actor.
One of the easiest people that I've ever had the privilege to work with, and one of the dearest friends that I've ever had the privilege to have in my life. He always a good word, never negative.
Simon most fondly remembers Behrens playing her husband while her now late partner Chance played the grandfather in the show Squabbles. She says that fit Behrens' skill best as a personality actor.
90% of the people on television are personality actors. You know, they do what they know how to do. But a hilarious comedian. And he wrote his own material, and he really had a wonderful stand-up act. He could do you 20 minutes, or he could do you an hour and a half.
Simon recalls Behrens also performed with George Rock of the Spike Jones Band, a group you might remember for this holiday classic. Rock had retired to Farmer City and had become ill. Rock died the day after the performance.
I don't know too many people that didn't love Ken Behrens.
Don Munson worked alongside Behrens for 30 years at WJBC. He recalled his fondest memories of Behrens came when Behrens would enter the studio during their 5 minutes of daily transition time between shows.
There was always laughter in that 5 minutes. He'd come in and open with a joke almost every morning. And just to harass him, I would do my best to keep a poker face and indicate just by my silence that I didn't think it was very funny. But it didn't bother him. Most of the time, well, at least much of the time, I would end up laughing anyway.
Munson notes the irony of their parallel lives and how it contrasted the content of their shows.
I always kidded him that we were so much alike because we both came from small towns. Ken came from Piatone, I from Gibson City. We were each an only child. Each of our dads had an automobile agency, Chevy for me, Ford for him. We each had two daughters. We ended up living in the same neighborhood.
Munson says Barron's draw was he made listeners comfortable. He says he stayed in contact with Barron's during his cancer battle.
The grace with which he handled that was just unbelievable. It wasn't like he avoided talking about it. He was willing to talk about it.
And longtime friend Dan Swain, he says that gets to the essence of who Ken Barron's was, someone who simply wanted to make you smile. And he says that persona came across the airwaves every day for decades.
If you wanted to talk politics, Ken could talk politics with you, but he chose not to because he always thought that his time on the radio was limited. Why not make it something that would make people happy? And to that end, I have no doubt and no reservation in saying Ken accomplished that goal very well.
Barron's retired from broadcasting in 2002, which means anyone college age or younger likely never heard his show. Swainy says they don't know what they missed. I'm Eric Stock.
Ken Barron's endured a 2-year battle with lung cancer. His friends call it a cruel irony. He did not smoke. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham and Eric Stock. And thanks to Mayor Chris Koos of Normal for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.